Crispin, the Cross of Lead, chapters 36 through 40. Chapter 36. But you, she said to Bear, must sit and slake your thirst. I want to know all you've learned since you've last been here. Bear relaxed. If you'll be so good as to fetch me a key to my room in the solar, the special one, he added, I'll settle the boy. Then we can speak. Though realizing I was being put aside, I said nothing, but simply followed Bear. Key in one hand, he led me up the steps to the second story. I had never climbed so high in a building before, so high that I furtively put a hand to the wall to steady myself. We went along a dark, narrow hallway until we reached a door, which he unlocked. Our solar, he informed me. Go on. I stepped inside. By the little light that seeped through a shuttered window, I observed a small room. Old rushes lay on the floor. A small, low table stood in one corner, and in another corner was a large pallet of hay. The place had a rank, close smell of sweat and ale that made me feel slightly ill, used as I was to open air. Bear fluffed up the pallet. Bear? What? This building, it's so high. Might it fall down? He looked at me for a disbelieving moment, then erupted into one of his big laughs. There is no chance. None. Please stop here and answer question one. There was a knock on the door. Widow Daventry entered. In her hands was a bowl with meat and thick sauce. Pieces of bread were mixed in. To my surprise, she offered it to me. I took it gratefully. Yours is below, she said to Bear, and left. I sat on the hay cross-legged, bowl in my lap, horn spoon in hand. As Bear moved his dagger and laid it on the table, I said, Will we perform here? I asked. I think not, he said to my further surprise. Our time here will be very short, but I must show you something. He went to the wall and felt about the wooden boards. This is a special room, he said. My friend below always gives it to me. Under the pressure of his hands, a slab of wood popped out from the wall. It is a hiding place. It will hold you and me too, for that matter, if there's need. Will there be a need? By all of heaven's sacred saints, I pray not. Bear? I looked directly at him. What is it you really do? He laughed. When we met, he said, you dared not even ask my name. Now you stare brazenly at me and presume to ask of my affairs. Have we risen in the world or fallen? That's for you to say, I said. As to what I really do, he said with a placating smile, I'm a fool because I should like to be in heaven before I die. He reached for the door. Please stop here and answer question two. I don't want to stay here, I said. It's close and ill-smelling. You'll do as you're told. Yes, master, I said, knowing my saying so would irritate him. Then at least don't lock the door. I won't, he said, then paused. For a moment I thought he would speak more, but all he said was, Crispin, on your life, remain here until I return. With that, he left. Feeling much aggrieved, I ate the food, then lay back upon the straw. I was not very happy. Why, I asked myself, should I remain in such a stuffy place while he did as he pleased? Besides, my glimpses of the town had only whetted my curiosity, and I had a penny of my own. There was much still to see, but it sounded as if Bear intended to keep me in the room for what now appeared to be a short stay. For a while, I remained where I was, though as time passed, I fretted more and more. Finally, I got up. Went to the door and peeked into the hall. Seeing no one about, I made my mind to wander the town for a short time. My intent was that I would return before Bear even noticed I had left. I was just about to leave when I went to the table and plucked up Bear's sheathed dagger and hid it under my tunic. Had he not taught me to use it? Was this not the town in which to claim my liberties? Moving quietly, I crept halfway down the stairs and listened. From somewhere, I could hear the murmurs of Bear's talk as well as Widow Daventry's. Exactly where they were, I didn't know. I continued down, until I was certain no one was in the tavern room. At the base of the steps, I decided it would be better if I didn't use the front door, lest they see me. Instead, I made a sharp turn and went along a narrow hall. At the end of it, I reached a small door. Pushing it open, I stepped into an alley that had the most appalling stench. It was the place where privies were set over open ditches. Holding my nose, I shut the door behind me and raced away. Please stop here and answer question 3. Chapter 37. It was mid-afternoon, shortly after the bells had rung for none, when I stepped away from the back door of the Green Man. Running, I regained the main street, and once there began to look upon the town at my ease. As I went about, the hurly-burly world of countless people, buildings, and wares struck me with even greater force. If anything, Great Wexley seemed more tumultuous, with more people, more happenings than even before. But I was feeling bold, and quite sure of myself. I didn't need Bear to see the world, thought I. As I stood upon the street, enjoying the buffeting of those who passed, not sure which way I wished to go, a crowd of children rushed by, yowling and laughing, curious to know where they would go and what they would do, I ran after them. The young people turned this way and that, and then, just as they had appeared, they vanished. I had not the slightest idea where they had gone. Though baffled, I was not a bit disconcerted. With so much to see, I was content to ramble on, pausing to look at whatever took my interest, of which there was no scarcity. As for my penny, I purchased some white bread from the street vendor. It was light and sweet and took little chewing to get down, which I found passing strange. After a while, I found the courage to leave the main stone-paved street and began to wander among back ways. These proved to be dirt and mud lanes. Though very narrow, they cast an even greater stench than the main thoroughfare. These ways twisted and turned in every conceivable direction, with no logic that I could grasp. Yet, I found myself excited not to know where I was going. How marvelously odd, I thought, to be required to pick and choose which way to go. What did I care that I had to make so many choices? It gave my head a pleasing whirl. And still more people, of so many kinds. Some I could see from the way they dressed, were poor. Yet even so, they appeared to mingle with others of far greater wealth, and no one took offense. In time, I found myself upon the main stone street again. It was there I saw a woman riding side saddle astride a great black palfrey, whose saddle and harness were trimmed with gleaming silver. Though the lady wore a black cape, I could see her gown. It was a brilliant blue, trimmed with golden fur. Her hair was tucked behind a squared-off, ruffled, knitted cap of black lace. Her feet were shod in golden shoes with pointy tips. Her small hands were encrusted with sparkling jewels. As for her face of elder years, it was pale and haughty and did not, or so it seemed, take in the world about her. Yet, as she went by, she pressed a silken cloth to her nose as if to block the offending street stench. Her nose knew where she was. Before her marched a boy, dressed entirely in black, a short gold and blue cape draped over one shoulder. He carried a long horn of bright metal from which dangled a flag of blue and gold. With every few steps he took, he lifted the horn to his lips and blared out notes to announce the lady's progress. Clustered around this lady were 6 men, wearing tunics with padded chests, their puffed sleeves lengthened to cover half their hands. One man led the lady's horse. Others marched on either side of her, while 3 more came behind. By the swords they carried, it was clear that they were her guards. Though not so sumptuously dressed as she, they were splendid enough to look upon in their blue and gold livery. On each left sleeve was a band of black. For me, she was an amazing sight. I had never seen such astounding wealth, another marvel for my eyes. As she passed, people on the street hastily made way for her, some doffing their hats or inclining their heads in reverence. Some even went down upon their knees, so I knew her to be a personage of great wealth. And yet, when the noble lady had once gone by, the crowds knitted together just as before, milling about, strolling, buying or selling. It was as if she had never been there. "Who is that?" I asked a boy standing near. He gave me a look of astonishment, as if I should have known. "Why, it's Lady Furnival." I turned quickly to look after her, but she had gone. Please stop here and answer question 4. Chapter 38. All afternoon I wandered in a kind of daze, beguiled by what I saw. It was as if my world had multiplied many times in size, numbers, and wealth. My eyes fairly ached with marvels seen even as my heart beat with sheer excitement. As for my anxiety about being in the town, it melted clear away. And then, at that point in my wanderings, when I thought I'd seen all there was to see, I came upon the town's great square. Here, in a vast open space, greater than Stromford's entire commons, buildings pressed in on all sides. Some seemed new, some old, some were straight while others sagged, but the square was dominated by two buildings that stood at opposite sides. By far the biggest structure was the great church, a cathedral, as I would learn, which soared upward with a multitude of towers. These towers, joined together by what looked like floating arches, were emblazoned with countless embellishments and statues that seemed as real as life. Set between the high front towers was a vast circle of stone and multicolored glass. Below it was the main entry, deep framed with columns and more statues. The whole gigantic structure seemed to rise toward heaven itself, stone leaping into glory. Opposite the church, on the other side of the square, was a large stone building some 3 stories tall. Whereas the church rose high, this building seemed to cling to the earth with a weight and bulk that bespoke earthly power. On its first level were big wooden doors over which had been set an open space caged in with metal bars. To either side of these doors were small windows similarly enclosed. But on the second level, at a considerable height, were 4 huge windows side by side with pillars and stone tracery. Set before the windows was a balcony under which stone lions' heads protruded. Flags with various designs of blue and gold hung on poles. Other flags were black. Here, too, soldiers paced. The third level had similar windows, but unlike the church, which stood alone, this building was hemmed in close on either side by ordinary structures. Between the church and this large building was a great open space, the town square itself. It held crowds of traders with booths and stalls with more sellers of goods and food than I could count. Swarms of buyers were in attendance. Most were walking, but a few were on horseback, wending their way through the middle of the crowds. I walked about the square, gazing at the endless numbers of things being sold, many of them objects I'd never beheld before. Cloth of many colors and types, Muscovy furs, Toledo daggers, Flemish hats, Italian gloves. There were baskets, boxes, and boots. There were shoes, tools, and armor. As for food and spices, why, I actually saw a bowl full of peppercorns. And everywhere, coins clinked and abacuses rattled. I wished I had not already spent my penny. Timidly, I approached the great church itself. For a while I stood before it, trying to decide if I might be allowed to enter. What, I wondered, might it be like to pray in such a place? But aside from its great size, it was the soldiers about the doors that made me hold back. Yet they seemed to be paying very little attention to the crowds of people who went in and out. When I saw children enter, I made the sign of the cross over my heart and went forward. In truth, the soldiers barely looked at me as I passed through the entryway crowned by statues of Mary and Jesus, plus other saints whose names I did not know. I promised myself I'd return with Bear, who would, I was certain, know them all. But when I stepped past the vestibule, I gasped. Before me was a space of such immense size, height, depth, and breadth that I never would have thought it could exist on mortal earth. Burning candles blossomed everywhere, enough to awe the stars. Through sweet and smoky air, great columns rose to dizzying heights, while enough multicolored lights poured down through stained glass so as to turn the hard stone floor into pools of liquid hues. From somewhere unseen, a chorus of swelling chant rolled forth, filling this celestial space with sounds that made me think of the measured beating of angels' wings. It was as if I had entered paradise itself. Any number of people were milling about or were on their knees in prayer. Afraid to go any farther, I sank to my knees too, pressed my hands together, and simply stared with wonder at the church itself, and then at the people. Please stop here and answer question 5. As I knelt, my gaze fastened on a particularly devoted man who was kneeling, hands tightly clasped in prayer. Though he was wearing a soldier's quilted canvas jacket, red leggings, and high leather boots, somehow he seemed familiar. After a while, he began to look about. As he turned, the hairs on the back of my neck began to prickle. In truth, I could hardly believe what I was seeing. It was none other than John Acliff, the steward of Stromford Village. Moreover, I now realized he was not alone, but attended by men dressed in the same livery as those the great lady I had seen had about her person. Even as I began to grasp who it was, Aycliffe shifted farther about. Before I could gather my wits, he turned full face toward me. Our eyes seemed to fasten on one another. It was as if neither of us could believe the other was there, and we were in Stromford's forest once again. But then he set up a cry, shouting, "There!" and pointed right at me. "The boy, the wolf's head! He's here! Catch him!" These men, taken by surprise, spun around, saw whom he meant, then began running in my direction, shouting, knocking down anyone who stood in their way. By then I had collected wits enough to leap to my feet and race out of the church. Once inside, I plunged into the mass of people in the square, pushing and dodging to get away. After leaving the square, I raced on without any knowledge of where I was, running through one narrow lane after another. I went in no particular direction and never paused to look back. All I could think was that I had to get back to Bear. How long I ran, I don't know, but I was still pelting through a particularly narrow lane when a man leaped out in front of me. "Halt!" he cried, his arms spread wide enough to prevent me from passing. Please stop here and answer question 6. Chapter 39. Gulping for breath, I halted and spun about, only to find that another man had come up behind me. I flung myself against a wall, even as I struggled to get Bear's dagger out of my pocket. With the two men keeping to either side of me, I was unable to confront them both. But one I saw had a large stick in his hand. The other held a knife. "Keep away!" I screamed, finally managing to pull Bear's dagger free from its sheath. Though my heart was pounding and my legs were shaking, I held it before me as Bear had taught me. The dagger caused my attackers to hesitate. In that moment, I made a clumsy lunge at the man with a stick. Not only did he nimbly leap out of the way, he brought his stick down hard on my wrist. The pain and shock were so great I dropped the dagger. The next moment, arms locked around me from behind. I kicked and butted my head back. There was a sharp grunt and the man's arms went slack, just enough to allow me to break his grasp. Head down, I charged straight at the man with the stick, catching him in the chest. He fell back. It was enough. With a burst, I ran past him down the alley. Then I plunged along a different narrow way, taking one turn after another, not daring even to glance back to see if I were being followed. I don't know how long I ran before I stopped and looked behind. Seeing no one, I allowed myself a moment's rest. Heart thudding to the point of pain, my wrist still smarting where it had been struck, I tried to grasp what had happened. Why Stromford Steward was in Great Wexley was something I could make no sense of. But what was clear was that, far from escaping my pursuers who wished me dead, I'd come to a place where they could trap me. In my frantic state, I was quite sure that not even Bear could protect me. What's more, I had disobeyed him. It was not a thing I was sure he would forgive, and hadn't he told me to run away if attacked? I made up my mind to leave the town. I would get beyond the walls and flee. Exactly where I'd go didn't matter as long as I escaped. While it was easy to make the decision, I quickly realized I had no idea where I was or where to go in order to leave. With my distress growing every moment, I looked around, trying to get some sense of my whereabouts. Please stop here and answer question 7. When I had first arrived in Great Wexley, I had been overwhelmed by the multitude of different things I saw. Now, in a complete turnabout, my panic made everything seem the same. What's more, I couldn't help but feeling that lurking behind each corner, each bend of each alley, would be more of my enemies. Still, I also knew I couldn't remain where I was. My pursuers had already proved they knew the town well enough to track me down. Moving with great caution, I wandered down one alley after another, spying ahead even as I constantly checked behind. What made things worse was that no matter where I went, I had the sensation I'd been there before. It was as if I could make no progress. But then I came to what seemed a good idea. Bear had told me that the Great Walls encircled the entire town. If that was the case, and I didn't doubt him, I suppose I could find some part of them as long as I walked a straight line in any one direction. Then, once I found the walls, I'd follow around till I came to the gate through which we had entered. From there, I'd make my exit from the town and flee to safety. Feeling somewhat less apprehensive now that I had a plan, I immediately set off. Though I hurried, I remained alert lest I blunder into another attack. Again and again I made myself slow down. Try as I did to follow a straight line, I soon discovered it was impossible. The alleys and streets meandered in ways that bewildered me. It was as if I were in a maze. Even so, I forced myself to go on because I was afraid to stay in any one place. So I made my way by hugging walls, slipping round corners, all but crawling. Daylight was fading. The long summer twilight had begun to ebb. With it came a resumption of chilly rain. Soon misty dimness cloaked the air. The brightest light came from within houses or the occasional passer-by who made his way holding a flaming rush or lantern before him. Fewer and fewer people were abroad. Shadows lengthened. Now and again men would stagger by, clearly having too much to drink. The only other noise, and it came from shuttered houses, was an occasional burst of laughter, an angry shout, a child called. At last I made my way out of the town walls. They rose high over my head and seemed to melt into the murky sky. Nor were they smooth walls, as I had imagined, but had houses built close against them. Even so, as far as I was concerned, I was making progress. Now, according to my plan, I needed only to follow the wall around. If I did, surely I would come upon the gate through which Bear and I had entered the town. Once again, my plan was faulty. The wall had not been built in a simple circle, but was in fact serpentine. Still, I continued on until I stumbled on a wide street paved with stone. When I recognized it as the one on which Bear and I entered the town, I started to run along it. Then two things happened almost simultaneously. The town's church bells began to ring, and I saw what appeared to be a gate in the wall. Some 9 or 10 soldiers were milling about it. A few carried flares. Though I wasn't sure if it was the same gate by which Bear and I had entered, I told myself it didn't matter. It was a way out of town. I ran towards it. Even as I did, the great doors, hauled by soldiers, swung in and shut. Not believing what I was seeing, I stopped, aghast, and watched as the soldiers dropped huge beams across the doors to brace them shut. Then they added chains and even locks to keep the doors securely closed. Having shut the gates, most of the soldiers began to stroll away, leaving only two behind. I drew close enough for them to notice me. "Did you want to leave?" one of them called. "Yes, sir," I said. "Too late. They're closed. They'll be open in the morning at prime. Now get yourself away. The curfew has begun. You should be behind doors." "Off with you," a soldier shouted. I turned and began to wander away. It had become night. The rain intensified. The streets, now swamps of muck and mud, were all but deserted, save for a few laggards. Even they moved hurriedly, no doubt wanting to get behind doors lest they be taken up and charged. Animals began to emerge, mostly pigs and dogs, but rats too. They were splashing about in search of things to eat. As night thickened, people put up their house shutters. The town grew even darker than before. Hearing the sound of marching, I turned quickly. Some 6 helmeted soldiers, armed with broad swords and bearing lanterns, were coming down the street. I leapt into a narrow alley and peered out. As they went by, one of the soldiers shouted out, "The hour of complaint is at hand. The curfew is in force. No one may be on the streets." As they passed, I shrank back, listening as the tramp and shouts grew fainter. It was night now. The town seemed asleep. The sky was black. The rain still fell. I wandered on, wet and miserable, looking for a place to conceal myself, hoping I might stumble upon the green man. The only sound I heard was the squish of my feet on the mud or stones. I hardly dared to breathe. Then I heard the sound of running feet. I pressed myself against the wall and peeked out around the corner. A group of men, torches held aloft, hurried past. By the light of their torches, I glimpsed their blue and gold livery. It was the same livery as Lady Furnival's entourage wore, but I recognized them as the steward's men. How could that be? Then I recalled something I had heard the stranger say in the forest. Aycliffe was Lady Furnival's kin. I wanted to think things through, but feared to take the time. Instead, I backed away and scurried down the narrowest of alleys, the walls so close I could have touched either side by stretching out both arms. I was halfway down it when I saw the hulking form of someone lurching toward me, hooded, lantern in hand. I stopped, turned, and began to run in the opposite direction, only to hear a thunderous, "Crispin, stop!" "Please stop here and answer question 8. Chapter 40. Hearing my name called so terrified me. I stopped and turned around. The man had drawn closer, but as I could not see his face, I shrank away. Only when the voice called out again, even angrier, "Crispin, you stunted son of a scoundrel," did I realize it was Bear. Heart exploding with relief, I ran toward him and flung myself at his knees, embracing him with fervor. "Where, by the sins of Lucifer, have you been?" the huge man said, setting his lantern on the ground. Prying me loose, then putting his great hands on both my shoulders, he made me stand before him. At the same time, he went to his knees so I could look into his eyes. "Bear," I said, unable to say more because I had put my arms about him and pressed into his neck and beard like an infant sparrow returned to its nest. "Crispin," he scolded, "I waited all afternoon for you to return. Did you forget me so soon? Is this the way you repay my kindness? I should give you a sound whipping."
I didn't mean to. I lost my way, and I was attacked."
"Attacked?" he said, prying me loose from his neck so he could look into my face. "By whom?"
"The steward's men."
"What steward?"
"From Stromford, John Aycliffe. He's come after me," I went on in a rush. "I saw him in the great church, but he saw me too. The moment he did, he set men upon me, and Bear, I remembered something else. He's Lady Furnival's kin. I saw her. You said Great Wexley was Furnival's principal home, that Stromford was one of his holdings. Now that Lord Furnival is dead, Lady Furnival must have summoned Aycliffe."
I feared that might happen.
"Why didn't you tell me?"
"I wanted to avoid it all."
My wrist is numb where they struck me.
"Then you'll have to walk on your feet," he said, grinning. With that, he turned about and began to wend his way back through back streets and dark alleys, his lantern barely showing the way through the dark and the rain.
"When I tried to defend myself," I said after we had gone for a while, "I lost your dagger."
"I'm sure you used it well."
"Bear," I said as we went along.
"What?"
"God bless you."
"And you also," he returned gruffly. Only when I was secure behind the doors of Widow Daventry's inn did I draw a fully relaxed breath. I looked about. The main room was deserted.
"Bear, you need to tell me what I should do if..."
The widow came into the room. As she did, Bear put up his hand to silence me.
"Ah," the woman said, "you found him."
"He was wandering and became lost," Bear said, not mentioning the attack.
"Did the watch see you?" she asked me. "I don't think so."
"Good," she drew herself up. "I'm afraid John Ball has just arrived."
"Where is he?" Bear said.
"In the kitchen. He demanded to be fed."
"Fine. I'll get the boy to the room. Can you fetch him something to eat and some dry clothes?"
"I'll get some," the woman said, and left the room. Giving me no explanation as to what his exchange with Widow Daventry had been about, Bear and I returned to our room. Once there, he set the lantern on the table, then bade me lie down on the pallet. When I did, Bear sat down by my side, but instead of speaking, became lost in his thoughts. Even so, I felt comforted. Widow Daventry opened the door and stuck her head inside. "He's getting anxious," she said.
"He always was the impatient man," Bear muttered. "I'm coming."
The woman left. Bear stood and stepped toward the door. "Now eat your bread and go to sleep."
"Will you truly forgive me?" I said.
"There's nothing to forgive. Sometimes I forget."
"Forget what?"
"How little you know." With no further words, he went away. Left alone, I hardly knew what to think. But after what had just happened to me and how he had come after me, I had no heart to question him. Please stop here and answer question 9 and 10.